I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, a new report describes horrors for children inside Syria.
You look at the faces and they're so expressionless. Children do not even know how to react to their new reality. Losing everything, leaving everything behind, your house, your playground, your school, peers.
Kurdish rebels release 8 Turkish captives. Iran and Armenia find solidarity in isolation. And a disappointed Arab world awaits Obama's Mideast trip. It's all ahead. Support for the Syrian opposition was one topic of discussion in Washington Tuesday when U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry hosted his Norwegian counterpart, Foreign Minister Espen Barth Eide. Mr. Kerry said he approaches dealing with the opposition with patience and care.
They are adamant, all of them, about what they're fighting for. And the cause is the cause of the Syrian people. And they have committed themselves to a broad-based government that is going to represent all of the people of Syria, even as there may be some dissension as to tactics or process among them. So you have to have some patience in this process, even as you approach it with care. And I think that's exactly what we're doing. We want to stop the killing. And they want to stop the killing. The world wants to stop the killing. And we want to be able to see Assad and the Syrian opposition come to the table for the creation of a transitional government according to the framework that was created in Geneva, the Geneva Protocol, which requires mutual consent on both sides to the formation of that transitional government. That's what we're pushing for.
Norway's Eide said it is crucial that the international community maintain a clear and united message on the conflict in Syria.
What is most important now is that the international community, and particularly the Security Council, aligns itself and comes out with a clear message on how to move forward towards a political process, which must include the end of the Assad regime, a kind of control end. And we should all support that. We can all play our roles in the humanitarian side. We support the opposition. We try to work with local council of the opposition. But this is really an area where more than sort of special roles, we need to have a collective effort and that whatever we do is good, well aligned with an overarching vision.
Norwegian Foreign Minister Espen Barth Eide speaking in Washington. 1 in 3 Syrian children report having been hit, kicked, or shot at during the country's bloody 2-year conflict, according to the charity Save the Children. Sayla Hennessy has details from London.
Save the Children's Saba Mubaslat spoke to VOA from Amman, the capital of Jordan. Syrian refugees have been flooding across the border into Jordan and other neighboring countries, many to stay in sprawling and overcrowded camps. Mubaslat describes watching the children as they arrive by bus at Zatari Camp, the largest in Jordan.
You look at the faces and they're so expressionless. Children do not even know how to react to their new reality. Losing everything, leaving everything behind, your house, your playground, your school, peers, extended family, and coming to a completely new place called a camp is devastating to children.
The charity's report, published Wednesday, references research carried out by Bahçeşehir University in Turkey. It says children have been targeted. Young boys, it says, are being used by armed groups as porters, runners, and human shields, and some girls are being married early to protect them from feared sexual violence. Mubaslat says many children arriving at camps appear traumatized. She describes one boy who, she says, didn't have the vocabulary to describe his experiences.
The only way by which that little kid could really express that tragedy by continuously drawing pictures of guns and dead bodies and a lot of red all around the page. It was really painful seeing that for a child who's 6 years old.
The charity's report says children inside Syria are under constant risk of malnutrition, disease, and trauma. A separate report published by the United Nations Children's Fund on Tuesday also highlighted the plight of children in Syria's conflict. It said nearly half of the 4 million people in need of aid inside Syria are under the age of 18. More than 500,000 are children under the age of 5. UNICEF estimates that 1 in every 5 schools in Syria has either been destroyed or is being used by displaced people seeking shelter. According to UN rules, non-governmental organizations must be authorized to work inside Syria by the Syrian government. About a dozen international NGOs have received that permission, but rebels say the distribution of aid is unequal. Save the Children wants the UN Security Council to back a plan to end the violence and ensure children across Syria get humanitarian aid. Spokeswoman Mubaslat.
Humanitarian organizations are waiting for a permission to go inside Syria and deliver services. Till now, we did not succeed in convincing the Syrian government that, you know, this access would lessen the pressure.
Save the Children compiled its report called Childhood Under Fire to mark 2 years since the start of Syria's conflict. Selah Hennessy for VOA News, London.
The Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, has released 8 Turkish citizens it had been holding captive. The move is part of ongoing peace efforts to end the decades-long conflict between the PKK and the Turkish state. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The handover occurred in neighboring northern Iraq, where the captives, a mixture of Turkish soldiers and civil servants, had been held for nearly 2 years. Turkish President Abdullah Gül welcomed the release. We are happy that our citizens who have been away from their country for so long and from whom we had not received any news are returning, he said. The release of the captives is part of a government-led initiative to bring an end to the 29-year conflict with the PKK. Deputy Prime Minister Beshir Atalay, speaking ahead of the release, described the PKK move as an important goodwill gesture and said peace efforts remain on track. Government talks with the Kurdish rebel leader Abdullah Öcalan, who has been held in a Turkish prison, started last year. Last month, Öcalan called for the release of the captives. Further steps are anticipated in the coming week, with the PKK expected to announce a ceasefire ahead of celebrations marking the start of the Kurdish New Year on March the 21st. Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan is also calling for a withdrawal of all PKK fighters from Turkish territory. Since 1984, the Kurdistan Workers' Party has been fighting for greater cultural and political rights and autonomy in a conflict that has claimed more than 40,000 lives. Much of the international community, including the European Union and the United States, has designated the PKK a terrorist organization. In a news conference, a senior PKK figure said with the release of the captives, the ball is now in Turkey's court. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
While the West seeks to isolate Iran over its disputed nuclear program, landlocked Armenia seeks to build relations with its neighbor without violating international sanctions. James Brook reports from Yerevan.
In all of Christian Armenia, there is one mosque, the Iranian Mosque. Restored 15 years ago by Iran, the mosque offers classes in Persian and is a must-see for visiting Iranian VIPs like Iran's President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who came to Yerevan 15 months ago to meet Armenia's President Serge Sargsyan. The West seeks to isolate Iran, believing it is trying to build a nuclear bomb, a charge Iran denies. But Armenia, blockaded by Turkey to the west and Azerbaijan to the east, seeks to quietly expand trade with its southern neighbor. Richard Girigosyan directs the Regional Studies Center in Yerevan.
Armenia is the only neighbor of Iran where the regime or the government in Iran feels quite comfortable and is actually keen to increase relations. From the Armenian perspective, there's a shared sense of isolation where both Iran and Armenia feel surrounded by either hostile or rival states and feel under blockade or sanctions.
Through a joint border only 35 kilometers wide, cargo trucks link this small landlocked nation with Iran, a nation with an economy 50 times the size of Armenia's. With the mountain highway slow and often dangerous, Armenians look for alternatives. Gohar Iskandarian of Armenia's National Academy of Science says a top priority is to extend Armenia's railroad south.
Մենք խնդիր ունենք այո ինվեստիցիաների գտնելու համար։ Իրանական կողմը այդ խնդիրը չունի, քանի որ մենք գիտենք Իրանում զարգացած է։
She says if Armenia can find the investment money for the rail link, it can one day export its goods through the Persian Gulf and on to the Indian Ocean. 6 years ago, Armenians started to heat their homes with gas coming through a new pipeline from Iran. Now, Armenia wants to build an oil pipeline from Iran and two hydroelectric power plants on the border. But Iskandarian says sanctions over Iran's nuclear program could block funding for these projects. She says major projects linking Iran and Armenia will ultimately depend on the approval of the big powers, the United States and Russia. While sanctions have hurt Iran's economy and cut trade with Armenia, Richard Girigosyan sees one bright spot.
The Iranian government has actually banned the import of luxury items, which includes laptops, makeup and cosmetic products, to even chocolate. Therefore, it will only encourage the rise or emergence of somewhat of a black market where Iranians coming to Armenia for tourism purposes begin to acquire these now prohibited consumer items.
Some Iranians come to Armenia looking for more than lipstick. Araik Vardanyan of Armenia's Chamber of Commerce says they are buying apartments. He says some Iranians may be looking for a safe refuge in case war breaks out in Iran over the nuclear issue. For the time being, the two isolated nations are linked by a tiny border and suspicion of their Turkic neighbors. James Brook, VOA News, Yerevan.
When President Obama arrives in Israel on the first leg of his Middle East trip on March 20th, he will face a region that is increasingly unstable. Iran is dangerously close to developing nuclear weapons. Syria remains engulfed in a bloody civil war. Israeli-Palestinian peace talks remain comatose. And there are many other problems as well. VOA is bringing you a special one-hour report on the president's trip. We invite you to join host Meredith Buhl at 14 hours 30 Universal Time Friday, right here on the Voice of America. Later this month, U.S. President Barack Obama visits Israel, the West Bank, and Jordan. Ahead of that, he has met with Jewish American and Arab American leaders. VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawy spoke with James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute, about his talks with the president about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
From the conversations that we had, I felt very good about the president's overall sense of the realities in the region and of president's commitment to reach out to both sides with a very strong message of a commitment to peace. I can't get into details, but the fact that the meeting occurred was very positive. And what the White House said to us, which has been reported in the press, that they're going to reach out to the Palestinian people with a message of concern and a message of support. And I think that reaching out to the people is what we were looking for, and that's what they indicate that they'll be doing.
What message did Arab American leaders convey to President Obama ahead of his Middle East tour?
All of us are of agreement. We're all disappointed that the first term did not produce any more movement. But we're all of agreement that the difficulties that exist cannot be ignored. A dysfunctional Israeli political system. An equally dysfunctional Palestinian political system that is deeply divided. A Congress that simply doesn't want to give any ground, any space for the president to maneuver. Those are realities that are difficult to contend with or to ignore. The president nevertheless is committed, and the issue is what can be done to change those realities, to change the political discourse here and there. What we proposed were, number one, what he's already doing, reaching out to the people, as Clinton did in 98, to go over the heads of the leaders, to speak directly to the people and say, this is the support we'll give to you. but this is what we need from you. And then to come home and build a constituency for peace here that actually, just as he's gone to the American people on health care and gone to the American people on budget priorities, he's got to go to the American people on the fact that there's a need for peace. I've already had conversations with people in the Jewish community who said, you know, he meets with each of us separately. He ought to be meeting with us both together, like Clinton did. When Clinton said that for there to be peace, there has to be a constituency that supports peace. That's the kind of thing that we said. We had ideas of who he should see and messages he should send and things he should do. But overall, the point is, go to the people with the message. Don't just speak with the leaders.
You said the president wouldn't have the opportunity to make a speech to the Palestinian people. What is the alternative for him to show his commitment?
Oh, look, we've been in campaign politics for so long that, you know, we know that sometimes a comment to a child walking into a meeting or a statement made to a clutch of people as you're leaving the meeting with press around can be maybe more important and more impactful than a speech. The problem with a speech is that it's got to be long. And, you know, you say so many things, and you have to hope that reporters pick out the correct line and use it. But, you know, to meet with a group of young people on your way into a meeting or in a receiving line and say, you know, I understand your history, I understand your past, I'm committed to your future, and I want to see you living free in an independent state, governing yourself with full freedom. Something like that can have a huge impact if it's said to people, because the three or four young people you say it to ultimately translate to saying it to an entire nation. And the problem of speaking with the leaders is that it doesn't have the same emotional impact as saying it to a couple of young people. So those are things that we proposed, and my sense is that, you know, we think it would be a good idea for him to do it.
James Zogby, president of the Arab American Institute. We hope to bring you more of his remarks Thursday on our program. President Obama's visit to the Middle East next week is being greeted with far less enthusiasm in the region than 4 years ago, when hopes were high for a new era in U.S.-Arab relations. VOA's Elizabeth Arad has more on the story from Cairo.
When Barack Obama came to Cairo 4 years ago, he was hailed as a son of Africa, a man whose middle name, Hussein, hinted at a fundamental shift in America's relations with the Islamic and Arab world. He even spoke an Arabic phrase during his address at Cairo University.
Assalamu alaikum.
In the audience that day was former intelligence officer General Sam Asif al-Yazil. He remembers thinking, we got a good one, and change was imminent. Fast forward 4 years.
The expectations were very high, but when you see it physically, it was much less than that expectation.
Among the disappointments was what many in the region saw as Mr. Obama's slow response to the Arab Spring uprisings against longtime U.S. allies, as in Egypt, and not enough help, especially economic, in the aftermath. This Cairo resident argues it's important for America and Europe to help now because they helped the dictatorships. Al-Yazil says the perception that the U.S. continues to side with the interests of governments rather than the people has not gone away.
The feeling now that the Americans are working for the Egyptian administration and other administrations without looking to the street people what they want.
Close collaboration with Yemen's government, for example, allows the U.S. to carry out drone strikes on suspected terrorists. But civilian casualties from strikes gone wrong have deeply alienated many ordinary Yemenis. Yet for the most part, Mr. Obama has earned praise for scaling back America's military role in the region. Outside observers like Professor Christian Doneth of the American University in Cairo welcome the U.S. limits.
The Obama administration has done a relatively good job in being very careful in its approach to Syria, given that there are a number of competing interests in Syria. And I think for now, one of the most important things that we can do is focus on the humanitarian crisis.
Doneth believes concern for humanitarian issues and economic outreach directly to the people could do much to improve America's standing. But he notes that one thing colors almost everything the U.S. does in the Arab world, America's close ties with Israel, which will be the focus of Mr. Obama's trip this time.
Fundamentally, this will be quite difficult for the U.S. to improve our relationship with the people, which seems to be what we're trying to do, without somehow addressing the Israel issue, and we haven't been doing that.
Even if Mr. Obama can help revive the peace process between Israel and the Palestinians during his trip, few expect the regional dynamic to change anytime soon. Elizabeth Tharrett, VOA News, Cairo.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.